Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a big bird with a 30-inch wingspan, distinctive black, white, and red markings, vivid yellow eyes. It was a swamp dweller in the deep south, a bird of rare presence and grace, and most scientists believed it, the ivory-billed woodpecker, was extinct. Some hunters and amateur birders in the Mississippi Delta refused to believe or dared to hope otherwise. They reported periodic sightings of the majestic bird and were written off as dreamers seeing what they wanted to see. Last week, that changed. Tonight on Point, the quest for the ivory-billed woodpecker and the amazing reappearance of a southern legend thought extinct 60 years ago. But first, we begin tonight with analysis of the suicide bomb attack in northern Iraq's Kurdish city of Erbil that has left at least 60 dead and 150 wounded. Hundreds of job seekers were gathered outside a police recruitment center when the bomb went off. A militant group the U.S. government says is linked to al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility, saying the attack was revenge for Kurdish cooperation with U.S. forces. Carol Murphy is correspondent with The Washington Post in Baghdad. I asked her to describe how the bombing caused so much devastation.
Well, there was a long line of men queued up to get applications to join the Kurdish police force. They were on a sidewalk outside a local party office, and the suicide bomber, according to Kurdish officials in Erbil, was wearing the traditional Kurdish dress of baggy trousers and a baggy blouse, and he had explosives around him, and he slipped into the line and apparently just detonated himself. An extremist group called Ansar al-Sunna, which is associated with al-Qaeda, according to U.S. officials, claimed responsibility for doing this.
This attack in Kurdish territory in the north came on the first full day in power for Iraq's democratically elected government. The president, of course, Jalal Talabani, is a Kurd. The prime minister, Ibrahim Jafari, a Shiite. What's the political message in the attack?
The political message is that we don't want you, this government, to succeed because we are against anything the Americans are trying to do in the Middle East. This government has a huge challenge ahead of it to get this insurgency under control. Right now, the insurgents are practically operating at will in much of the country, not everywhere, but in much of it, including much of Baghdad. So the government really has to come to grips with the fact that it's got to get itself organized, it's got to start providing services to people, and it's got to take some hard choices in getting this insurgency under control.
Carol, just last week, President Bush described the effort in Iraq as going well, but just in the last few days, since May 1st, 15 American troops killed. In recent days, bombings all over the place, as you say. How does it look to you? Is Iraq slipping away from this government? Is it slipping away from U.S. oversight?
Look, the government has, as I said, a huge task ahead of it. I wouldn't say things are out of control yet for this government. They may be teetering at the brink, but, you know, in the background, there are still over 130,000 American troops here who, if they wanted to, could take a higher profile. They're deliberately trying to keep a low profile in order to get the Iraqi security forces up and running and willing to take responsibility for fighting the insurgency. So I think it's too early to say that they're facing a failure, but they do have a lot of work ahead of them.
We're seeing these attacks interpreted as demonstrating the anger of Iraqi Sunnis who ran the country under Saddam Hussein, who now are more or less on the outside looking in. The Kurds have been autonomous for a long time. Do you see sectarian mistrust growing? How are the Kurds going to take an attack like this? Are the Kurds and Shiites still determined to work together?
Yeah, I mean, certainly sectarian feelings are growing. This particular group that perpetrated this attack today is a very extremist group. It's made up of Sunni Muslims, yes. There are both Kurds and Arabs in it. What I think is more of a problem is the political squabbling among politicians here in the cabinet, in the capital, which has meant that it took 3 months to form a cabinet. This country cannot afford to have a government that's paralyzed, cannot afford to have a government run by politicians who are looking out for themselves first instead of the country first. So right now, that's almost as big a danger as the insurgency.
Well, high tension there, not a fast track toward being organized, and a tragic bombing today in Erbil. Carol Murphy, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Carol Murphy is correspondent with The Washington Post. She spoke with me from Baghdad. It sounds almost too good to be true. After years of reports of creatures added to extinction lists, a dazzling bird that scientists had given up on years ago has been rediscovered. Last week, from Arkansas, the first confirmed sightings of the ivory-billed woodpecker in almost 60 years were announced. It's a story of hope, but also one of personal devotion and quest. Tonight on Point, the Cornell birder, whose sighting last year brought the big bird back from what most everyone thought was the dead. You can join our conversation tonight. Have you heard the story of how the ivory-billed wood wonder we thought was lost was found? And birders, what do you make of it? Are you astounded? Are you convinced? What's the moral in the reappearance of the one they call the Lord God bird? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Tim Gallagher, author of The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-Billed Woodpecker. He's director of publications at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology and was part of the team that rediscovered the ivory-billed woodpecker last year. Tim Gallagher, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
What a story. And it's nearly a year ago that this really began to come back to life, but only last week that we all heard about it. It's made a tremendous splash. Everybody's talking about it, writing about it, celebrating. What is it about the ivory-billed woodpecker that had the whole birding world, at the very least, primed to drop confetti and balloons when it was seen?
Well, it's amazing. Actually, people are really surprised that we could keep the secret so long. I mean, of course, all birders are blabbermouths. But
you sure did it, and it's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a spectacular bird. I mean, there are so many people who've dreamed of seeing it for so long, and it's so tragic what happened to it, how the habitat was destroyed, you know, all across the South, the bottomland hardwood forests, millions of acres. And just to think that it's alive is just incredible. You know, I don't know if you remember in 1999, a Louisiana State University student was out hunting turkeys, and, you know, David Cullivan, and he reported seeing a pair of them. And he was grilled by some pretty skeptical ornithologists who were convinced he saw the bird. And that was just like a dream come true to a lot of us. It was so hopeful. The birds are going to be all right. There's a pair. They're going to breed. And but 3 years of subsequent searching, no one ever found any of the birds. It was in the Pearl River area of Louisiana.
And this is after decades and decades.
Yeah,
when anyone
yeah.
who said they saw the bird was considered kind of...
like a Bigfoot chaser.
Right, kind of a nut.
Yeah, exactly.
Tim, take us back. We're going to get to the whole story of how this finally came to the fore, what you saw last year, why you kept it under wraps, how you confirmed what you saw down there. But I wish you'd take us back to just a description of the bird, how common it once was, and why so much attention was lavished on it. Give us some of the history of our interaction with with your great woodpecker.
Well, it was never extremely
the ivory-billed.
Yeah, it was never extremely common, but it was always humans were always fascinated by it. Even the Native Americans used to make headdresses out of it and have pipes, and later Audubon and Wilson and other artists, they actually killed the birds so they could draw them, but they were very fascinated by them. And
Audubon called it the chief among American woodpeckers. I mean, had a high,
right, exactly.
The great chieftain of the woodpecker.
Exactly.
And people called it the Lord God bird. Was it that impressive when you saw it? We've all seen lots of birds.
Well, it was, and I'd seen, probably more than 100 specimens of these birds, like a century old specimen in Harvard and places like that. And it was so much more stunning in life. I mean, this is a bird, swift-flying bird, flew straight, almost flew more like a pintail duck than a woodpecker. Didn't have that kind of lazy bounding flight.
We've got a lot of images of it at onpointradio.org. People can see it there. I have to say, it looks, I mean, it's kind of the classic woodpecker, but very big in the male with this wonderful red top dress.
Yeah, and the white bill. But the bird looked much blacker than I thought it would be, and the white was whiter. And you know, the white goes all the way to the trailing edge of the wing, and that's what really separates it in flight from a pileated woodpecker.
You've got stories of people who collected these birds only to have them kind of try to peck their way out of hotel rooms.
Alexander Wilson did that. He had one, you know, it was screaming, making a noise almost like a baby. And
this is 100 years ago or something.
Oh, it's more than that. It was in the early 1800s.
Yeah.
And he went into a hotel in North Carolina with it hidden in a basket, and he told him he had his baby in there, and everyone was shocked. And then he pulled it out and showed the bird. But it tore his room apart. It almost escaped. It ruined a mahogany table and almost tore through the walls to get out.
And other collectors who sent hunters into the woods knowing exactly what they were looking for, but between the immense logging of the South and that picking off the final, it was really what the 1940s that the last confirmed sighting was recorded.
Right. Don Eckleberry, the artist, he was sent there by the Audubon Society. Richard Poe, who was also from the Audubon Society and was later the first president of the Nature Conservancy, he had found the bird in December of 43, and Don Eckleberry went out there to sketch it. And he spent time with Gene Laird, the warden there.
And ever since, it almost retreated into the realm of myth. Tim Gallagher, we want to get all the details tonight. We're so glad you're with us. Tim Gallagher's new book is The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-Billed Woodpecker. We've got the whole story right here. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the quest for the ivory-billed woodpecker, the amazing reappearance of a southern legend thought extinct 60 years ago. My guest tonight is Tim Gallagher. He's editor-in-chief of Living Bird and director of publications at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. He's a wildlife photographer and author. His latest book, just out on the heels of the announcement of this sighting, The Grail Bird, as in Holy Grail, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-Billed Woodpecker. You can join our conversation tonight. Have you heard the story of how the bird we thought was lost was found? And birders, what do you make of it? Are you astounded? Are you persuaded? Does this story turn you from a sense of loss to a sense of hope? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tim Gallagher, I want to invite the bird on the air for just a moment with us, if I may, and have you explain what we're hearing. This is some sound of the ivory-billed woodpecker. I'm not sure we'll call it beautiful, but you tell us. Let's listen. There it is, both the Kent, the call, and I think we heard a little bit of actual pecking there. Where did this sound come from? And I must say, it must be music to the ears of those who would search for the bird. Where did the sound come from, and what does it tell us about the bird, Tim?
Oh, that was from a 1935 expedition to northeast Louisiana near Tallulah, Louisiana. It's a place called the Singer Tract. It was 80,000 acres of primeval forest. And the birds were rediscovered there. And a team from Cornell went there, led by Arthur Allen, who actually founded the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Mm. And they took motion pictures of the birds and made the first sound recordings. So those are still the sounds people use if they're trying to do playbacks to attract a response from a bird.
Tim, describe for us the environment that this bird lives in, I guess. What's the setting in which you found it, in which it once thrived?
Well, it was in the deep swamps, you know, in the cypress and tupelos, but also in the higher, you know, where the oaks, the higher ridges, oaks and sweet gums grew. And they would forage there on dead and dying trees, usually really huge trees. You know, in an old-growth forest, there's constantly dying trees, so there's a lot of food for the birds. They eat these grubs that are under the bark.
And when did that environment get wiped out? Over what period?
Oh, well, after the Civil War, you know, it was a lot of the northern companies especially came down and bought up the logging rights for peanuts and just did a lot of clear cutting all across the South. And I mean, by the turn of the century, you know, 1900, I mean, they were taking millions of board feet a year out of those swamps. And it just went on year after year until basically by mid-century, the South was pretty well clear cut.
Teddy Roosevelt talked about this being just absolutely astounding, even in his time getting around it, but it was soon nearly gone.
Yes, it's amazing that no one did anything to save those trees back then, because like you say, in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt said there's nothing else in the East like this and no other trees this big until you go all the way to the redwoods and sequoias. We didn't preserve it with like Yosemite and Yellowstone.
You describe the ivory-billed woodpecker as being a symbol, really more than a bird until this sighting last year, and a reminder of loss.
Yeah, it just brought home to me the fact that I can't take my children out and show them that kind of primeval, bottomland southern forest, and that's the big hope now is that this bird will. The rediscovery of this bird will galvanize people to save this land, to preserve it. I mean, the Nature Conservancy is working really hard now to acquire a lot of habitat along the Cache River and White River drainage in what they call the Big Woods of Arkansas.
I'm looking at what was the range of the bird, right along the South Carolina and Georgia coasts, Florida, mm-hmm. of course, up through Alabama, and then this big range up along the Mississippi from the Delta north. Describe where mm-hmm. you were for us. This is in eastern Arkansas, mm-hmm. not far from the Mississippi River, but not on it either. What's the setting there?
Well, we were on a long, narrow bayou. It was actually a cypress and tupelo swamp. And we had gone there because we'd heard a really promising sighting. A kayaker called Gene Sparling mm-hmm. saw he put it on a canoe club listserv, what he'd seen, and it was such a compelling sighting. And a friend of mine forwarded me the description, and I interviewed him 6 days after the sighting, and it was amazing. I mean, he either saw an ivory bill or hallucinated. And I called my friend Bobby Harrison of Oakwood College in Alabama, and he called him also. We compared notes, and we were out there a few days later with him canoeing down the bayou. We were going to spend a week camping out there.
We'll get to how you actually saw it, but don't steal our thunder quite yet on that.
Okay.
Because I think we want to understand this backdrop of many, many years in which people who saw or thought they saw the ivory-billed woodpecker either were written off as dreamers or didn't even announce they saw it because they were afraid of being laughed at.
Yeah, I mean, there were some famous examples, like John Dennis, the ornithologist and bird author who... he had found a pair of ivory bills in Cuba in 1948 and photographed the nest, you know, the last picture someone took of a nesting pair of ivory bills. And yet when he said he found ivory bills in East Texas in the Big Thicket country in the 1960s, I mean, people kind of laughed at him.
So when you heard what Gene Sparling or read what he'd written on the listserv, what was the mind that was sinking into? What was your state of mind? How long-standing was your interest in the ivory-billed woodpecker? Did you really believe that they might still be out there?
Well, I had first become interested in them in the early 1970s. I actually read a Life magazine article about John Dennis, and that got me inspired. But like I mentioned earlier in the program, the David Cullivan sighting, and you know, I was so disappointed that nothing came of that. Like, no one was able to find the bird. So that inspired me to really start checking all these sightings. I interviewed people across the South who said they'd seen these birds. And if they sounded promising, I went out there and checked the swamps.
And within days of reading what Gene Sparling had posted, you were down there in a canoe with your friend Bobby Ray Harrison. We'll hear from Bobby Ray in a few minutes.
Oh, good.
And what was that like?
You mean how
did you begin to just set off into the bayou to find the bird that couldn't be found?
Oh, it was almost like the scene from Deliverance, except for the banjo music. But we were camping out down there and just floating down the bayou. And the second day, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Bobby was complaining about starving because it was past lunch, you know. And Gene went way up ahead looking for a place to, dry spot of land so we could sit and eat lunch. And
because you're here in canoes, and I guess Gene's in a kayak. And to picture this, you've got to see all these trees coming right up out of water. Dry land is a rarity here.
Yeah.
Hold the moment right there. I want to turn to Huntsville, Alabama. Bobby Ray Harrison joins us. He's Associate Professor of Art and Photography at Oakwood College, specializes in bird photography. He was in the canoe with Tim Gallagher on that fateful day. Bobby Ray Harrison, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
You, too, had a longstanding obsession with the ivory-billed woodpecker. I understand the den of your home is a den of images of this bird.
Yeah. Kind of so. I've got a number of paintings up here. In fact, Tim and I had been interested in the bird, and we didn't know it for 14 years that we had both been interested in the bird. And finally, I told him one day that I had gone down to the Pearl River, and he said, "Are you interested in the ivory bill?" And I said, "Yeah." And we had known each other 14 years and didn't know that each of us had that interest.
Partly out of embarrassment because it's such a futile interest, or was thought to be.
Well, you don't tell a lot of people that you're going to look for an extinct bird.
Especially the way you do it. I'm looking at a photograph here in Tim Gallagher's book, Bobby Ray, and I must say, they call this the Lord God Bird, but if I ran into you in the bayou in this super camouflage getup, you've got to camouflage head to toe, your canoe's all camouflaged, you've got that sort of crazy camouflage foliage on your head. I mean, you were a serious expeditioner here looking for the bird.
Well, I frightened a few people out in the swamp.
I bet you did.
You know, though the rumors aren't true, I am not the White River Monster.
you might pass for it with that get-up on, but I'm sure it's effective. So there you were. It's about lunchtime. Gene Sparling is up ahead of you. Generations of birders have dreamed and died without success of seeing this bird. And Tim Gallagher, what happened?
Well, this bird just came flying up a side slough to the right of us and then just came right across the big open area in front of us in perfect light and, you know, just like 65, 70 feet in front of us. And, of course, we almost fell out of the canoe. and we both said at the same time, "Ivory Bill!" And, then just started paddling over to the side as quick as we could, and we jumped out and were immediately knee-deep in mud, scrambling through there.
Trying to follow it, trying to see where it landed?
Yeah, we had our camcorders going then, and we just wanted so badly to get a photograph of this bird. And it appeared to land a couple of times and hitch around the tree because we'd lose sight of it for a few seconds and then see it again. And finally, when we stopped, Bobby sat down on a log and just started sobbing and saying, "I saw an ivory bill. I saw an ivory bill." And I just was speechless.
Bobby Ray Harrison, I noticed that Tim Gallagher talks a lot more about you crying when you saw it than himself, but he does admit that he had a tear come to his eye later on as well. Do you remember the emotions of that moment?
Oh, it was unbelievable. I know Tim was shaking and I was shaking. Tim looked like he'd lost all the blood out of his body. He was so white. His eyes, you know, the old saying that eyes as large as a silver dollar.
Yeah.
I'd never seen it until that day.
When you saw that bird fly down the slough and then across in front of you, if you can slow it down in slow-mo, what did you see and what persuaded you so conclusively there that this was the bird that many believed was extinct?
Well, when we came around that bend out of the lake and we're looking off to the right, I see this bird flying through the trees. It's flying very rapid, shallow wing beats, and I'm looking at it and thinking, "This is interesting. I don't recognize this." And I'm a very experienced birder. There's not many birds I wouldn't recognize. Not thinking that this is an ivory-billed woodpecker, but when it broke over the slough and it turned on edge, there was that diagnostic wing pattern. It's something that I have studied all my adult life. That is diagnostic of the ivory-billed woodpecker.
And that is the deep black with the white edge along the wing.
Yeah, the white secondaries and the white extending into the inner three primaries on this particular bird. Some birds it will extend into the inner four primaries. We were so close, I could even see the light reflecting off the veins of the feather. But when I saw that pattern, it was instant recognition. I knew exactly what we were looking at. And the black is such a deep, rich black. It's almost a purple black. It's so deep.
Tim Gallagher, I believe it was a male you saw. Could you make out the red crest?
No, actually, we did not see red on our bird. I mean, the fact that we didn't see it doesn't mean it wasn't there, but...
so maybe I've got it wrong. What was it, male or female, or have you even distinguished?
Bobby and I thought it was a female, but, you know, I think three of the sightings people saw red, which would definitely be a male, but...
These are subsequent sightings.
The rest, the fact that we didn't see it doesn't mean it wasn't there, but I think we would have seen it. We were in such good light. So, I mean, we're hoping that means there's at least two, so...
Yeah, of course, a lot of speculation about that. Tim Gallagher, Bobby Harrison, a lot of callers want to join this conversation tonight. I want to begin to bring them in. Mead is calling from Bronx in New York. Hi, Mead, you're on the air.
Hi. I, as a child, I would travel between Mobile, Alabama, and Greene County, Mississippi. And it was one Thanksgiving that I had gone out on my own, and I saw a huge woodpecker, and it was just enormous. It was one of the biggest birds that I had seen there, and what was most striking about it was the way that it would fly. It was like it would just flick out its wings like a switchblade and shoot and then latch onto a tree and then do that again. And it was this year, around Christmas time, I was with my dad and family in Mississippi.
Yes.
And two of them swooped down in front of our house, and I took out the camera. I told my brother these were ivory-billed woodpeckers, that they're thought extinct. And to hear that now, finally, someone actually has seen this, this is awesome. This is just awesome.
Mead, do you remember as a child telling your parents about this or family?
Yeah, it's weird. You know, I said, you know, I saw this huge, huge woodpecker, and it was like, okay, that was it. It's really weird how some of the people regard wildlife in those areas.
In what sense, Mead?
Well, for instance, there's this sort of... sense of snakes being evil, and they'll kill just about every snake that they see, and they sort of take on these mythological qualities, some of these albino deer that exist, that sort of thing. There wasn't really any serious study that I could say that I knew of the wildlife there in this rural community.
But you felt like you'd seen the self-same bird. Mead, thanks very much for that report. Tim, what do you make of that? Decades of people now and then publicly reporting that they'd seen it here. Mead thinks he saw it as a kid and may have even seen a pair as recently as a year ago. You live there in the middle of the ornithology community. How do you respond to a report like that?
Well, you know, we get a lot of reports, and we usually want to really talk to someone like that and try to evaluate what they've seen and basically grill them, you know. And I don't want to give out a lot of hints about what I'd say because then everyone will know the right things to say.
but you were grilled when you came back from your sighting with Bobby Ray Harrison.
Yes.
And
yeah, I was.
Were you able to convince the pros at Cornell Ornithology that you had actually seen the bird? I guess you were.
Oh, I was a wreck. I mean, I came in. I couldn't fake that. I had to tell John Fitzpatrick, who's the director of the Lab of Ornithology, where I work. I mean, he's a serious scientist, and I didn't know how he'd take this. And I was hovering around his office Monday morning. I'd just gotten in from the airport the night before. I hadn't slept for 3 days. And he told me later he thought I was going to tell him I had an incurable disease. I looked so bad, you know. But I guess I did. Ivory bill fever. But... He grilled me, and he tape recorded what I said, and he finally said, I believe you, and we're going to do something about it.
We're going to hear about what that was after we take a short break here. But Bobby Ray Harrison, when you went home and talked to your family, talked to your friends, did they think you'd gone off the deep end, or did they hear the ring of truth in this report?
Well, I hadn't talked to very many people when I got home, but there was no one who had doubted what I had told them, simply because they knew that I had been looking for so long, and I was quite skeptical about a lot of reports. And I have looked at a lot of these reports and said they simply can't be ivory bills, but I still believe it's there.
We're going to hear a lot more about this story tonight. We're talking with Tim Gallagher, author of the new book, The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-Billed Woodpecker, and Bobby Ray Harrison with us tonight from Huntsville, Alabama, who was right with him there in the canoe when they saw the bird they call the Lord God Bird. You can join the conversation tonight. Does this story turn you from a sense of loss to a sense of hope? Are we hungry to believe the ivory-billed story because it seems to lift a burden of guilt for the destruction of the great forests? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about how a legendary bird's stunning reappearance has restored hope for the American wild. My guest, Tim Gallagher, he's Director of Publications at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, author of The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-Billed Woodpecker. And also with us tonight from Huntsville, Alabama, Bobby Ray Harrison, a bird photographer and associate professor in art and photography at Oakwood College there. He was with Tim Gallagher in the canoe when they saw the ivory-billed woodpecker. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you imagine being there in the Arkansas swamp seeing the grail bird? And what's the lesson of the ivory-billed woodpecker's second act? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David is calling from Enid, Oklahoma. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I was a wildlife science student at Texas A&M in the early 70s, and we made numerous field trips over to East Texas. And it was always reported that there was a few people over there that knew where there were some ivory bills, but they just weren't telling anybody. Doesn't there have to be a pretty good population up and down through there that we just haven't found in all these years?
Well, that's a good question. Tim, what's the presumption from the sighting? And we'll talk more about exactly what's transpired, but are we looking at one, the last one, one of a pair, one of many? What are people projecting from what's been seen?
Well, I mean, there's no way we can say, but of course the odds against us stumbling upon the last, you know, ivory-billed woodpecker in the world are astronomical. I mean, this bird had to have parents, I mean, perhaps even in this century. So I think we're going to have to start looking at all these places more seriously now.
How long do they live? 60 years since the last confirmed sighting? What's the lifespan, typically, of an ivory bill?
Well, we don't know the exact lifespan. It's probably 10 to 15 years, mm-hmm. probably maybe 20 at the outside.
But can you imagine, as David suggests, that there might be a population scattered right throughout that sort of dense area of East Texas and elsewhere? If so, why haven't there been confirmed sightings?
I think there are so few of these birds that they're just managing to slip by under the radar. I mean, they're not living in the most hospitable places for humans. I mean, you know, a lot of people are always saying, well, there's so many bird watchers in the United States, surely they would have seen them if they were still here. But birders don't go out in those swamps. They walk out on the boardwalk 100 feet, and that's about it. And, you know, you have to be deep in those swamps. And it's also hard to see the bird when they fly by. I mean, you're always getting tantalizing glimpses of birds like that. And, you know, I believe they're in other places. I don't think this is the only one in Arkansas.
But not many. Tim, describe for us the follow-up. After your sighting that day with Bobby Ray Harrison, what was the follow-up that led people to kind of sit on this and sit on it and think it through and finally come out just last week and say, yes, these are confirmed sightings? What went on after your first sighting?
Well, we had some more people come down from Cornell, and we spent, I don't think anyone saw it for about 4 weeks after that, so it was a little scary. I thought my reputation is really on the line here. Mm-hmm. And then we started having some sightings in April 2004. And then toward the end of April, on April 25th, David Leno, one of our colleagues at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock, he had a video camcorder running in his canoe and flushed an ivory bill off the bottom of a tupelo and you know, got a video of it flying directly away from them. And it's not a great video, but you can see the field marks on it. And we finally, that was the best footage we got of the bird. And you know, that's why in March of this year, when we were preparing that article for the journal Science, we totally you know, measured everything. We went back to the spot and measured the tree it came off, mm-hmm. and recreated it. Bobby made models of flying models of a life-size ivory bill and a life-size pileated woodpecker, and we've made them their wings flap and filmed them. Just
the pileated
seeing,
being the much
yes.
more common woodpecker. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And this bird is larger than any pileated, and it's got all the field marks of an ivory bill, the white going to the trailing edge of the wings. And
as we talk tonight, Tim, you write right at the beginning of the book, you say, "I think I've always been the kind of person who gets caught up in obsessive quests, most of which seem to involve birds." Clearly, you were obsessed with this bird. You wanted to find this bird. You believed, even before you saw it, that if it could ever be found, it would be a great statement about the importance of land conservation. Do you ever, in the middle of the night, doubt yourself and even doubt the subsequent sightings and that little bit of blurry videotape and wonder if maybe it is still extinct and it's a dream?
You know, I've never doubted my sighting. I mean, there was even, I almost wished that I could have said, well, I'm 80% sure, or just like to hedge mm-hmm. my bets a little. And no, I would have been lying if I said I was not 100% sure. And that, I've been unwavering in that conviction.
Bobby
and
Ray, so, how about so you? Any shred of doubt?
None whatsoever. You know, when you study something so long and you see it, you know what you're looking at. It's just that preparation that I've done over the years.
Mm-hmm. And there it was right in front of your face. Lindsay's calling from Boston. Hi, Lindsay. You're on the air.
Hi there. We have an old family friend who owns a really big tree farm out in Arkansas, and she has a law practice, and I know that she's done for a number of years a lot of conservation work and bringing lawsuits and stuff to protect certain tracts of land, and I'm just curious if conservation was a really big part of, you know, how the land in that area where they found the bird was actually preserved.
It's a great question, Lindsay. Thanks for raising it. Tim Gallagher.
Well, definitely. I mean, the part of the Cache River refuge where we saw the bird, I think 15 years ago they were planning to channelize it. They would have cut all the trees and had a straight channel. And, people fought against that. And the Nature Conservancy acquired a lot of that land and then gave it to the refuge. And, I mean, that's a great story. Otherwise, we wouldn't have seen that bird. So it's wonderful what's already happened.
I'm just reading here today Governor Mike Huckabee in Arkansas saying that the woodpecker's discovery, the ivory bills, will, quote, be a huge benefit to tourism. Look for a lot of folks coming to Arkansas and maybe spending their good old money and of course, tromping around and paddling around looking for the bird. You were afraid last year that when and if word of this got out, that you'd have thousands of people descending on this swamp and others and maybe drive the bird right out. Do you still have that fear, Tim Gallagher?
Well, I think they're managing it. I mean, they've got this program, Managed Access, where in the sighting area, they're not going to let people go floating through there. They're going to put up some towers soon. They already have some kiosks and places where you can go. And actually, I think when they put those towers up, I think there are going to be three or four of them, you'll have as good of a chance of seeing an ivory bill as you would paddling through a dense swamp, because it is hard to see them in there.
And so
we were lucky it flew across an open area.
Mm-hmm. Stay away from the cottonmouth snakes. Stay up on the platform.
Oh, yeah.
You might see something. Bernie's calling from Tuckahoe, New York. Hi, Bernie. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. I just want to pick their then what a question. I know the ivory bill was found, and that's awesome. Totally great. And I'm just worrying about possibilities of a couple other birds have been considered vanished, and would like to think that they may somewhere be out there, but like the Carolina parakeet, the heath hen, the Labrador duck, the great auk, or the passenger pigeon. And the reason I actually picked up a book recently from a fellow named Christopher Kukinos in the bookstore, and it's called A Hope is a Thing with Feathers, and I haven't actually had a chance to reread it, and it just was like about a couple months ago, and this busy, but
it's a great question, Bernie. Our time is short. Let us pick it up. And of course, Bernie's quoting Emily Dickinson there, Hope is the Thing with Feathers. You open up a big hope chest with the sighting of this bird. What do you think, Tim, about extending that hope onto the other list? Are we back to the passenger pigeon and the dodo is going to be sighted here?
I think most of the ones he mentioned, there's very little hope, very little hope. But it could be the Beckman's warbler. A lot of people have thought that was extinct, and small warbler. You know, I think that could still exist, and perhaps the Eskimo curlew.
So a couple of possibilities.
Yeah.
Bobby Ray, what's your sense of the moral of this whole story? People thought the bird was gone. They called others nutcakes when they thought they'd sighted it. Now you've seen at least one. Maybe there are more. Maybe there's a small population still tucked away. What do we learn from this about where we've come to in our relationship with the land in this country, in the South, and what might lie ahead?
Well, you know, I think this proves that, you know, life is resilient. And here we have, in this country, tried to do everything we can to destroy this bird, but yet it hung on. And now this bird is becoming a symbol of what we can save and what we need to save.
Does the fact that you saw it last year, to your mind, guarantee that it will go on, or could it still be lost?
Well, I'm kind of optimistic. I believe that these birds are actually on an increase, and that is the reason there have been a number of good sightings over the recent years. The only way we're really going to save this bird, though, is to make sure and ensure that we keep these forests improving.
And Tim Gallagher, what are the prospects for that? Is there more land coming into conservancy?
Yeah, just in that big woods area, I think we've acquired like 18,000 acres since this project began that the Nature Conservancy has. We've been working closely with them.
Well, it's a terrific prospect, and it's a terrific story. I won't get tired of thinking of the two of you in your canoe out that day, a little hungry and looking up and seeing history flash across the sky. Bobby Ray Harrison in Huntsville, Alabama, it's wonderful to have you with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Tim Gallagher in Ithaca, New York, editor and director of publications at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, author of the new book, The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-Billed Woodpecker. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Listeners, for a photo gallery of images from the search for the ivory-billed woodpecker, go to our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point. Tomorrow is May 5th, Mexico's great holiday, Cinco de Mayo. It marks the day in 1862 that the Mexican army, led by General Ignacio Zaragoza, defended the hills around Puebla, Mexico, against an invading French army. Cinco de Mayo is a Mexican holiday that's grown into a coast-to-coast celebration across the United States for all Latinos, Mexican or not. And nowhere are the festivities bigger than in Los Angeles, where last weekend over 500,000 people got the party started with food, music, and pan-Latino flair. On Point contributor Jennifer Westaway was there, and she sent us this radio diary from L.A.'s biggest street party.
My first clue that Cinco de Mayo in L.A. wasn't just any 5th of May party came at the grocery store. Into the bag went my free-range chicken, soy milk, green tea extract, did I mention I live in California, and then the clerk added a flyer from the police. English on one side, Spanish on the other, a picture of a gun at the top, and at the bottom, a photo of a dead woman in a coffin. The gist of the text was, what goes up must come down. Please don't fire bullets in the air on Cinco de Mayo. Well, yeah, or on any other day, I'm braving bullets just driving down the freeway. 4 drivers killed in L.A. in the last couple months. Random, senseless. But there's only so much you can worry about. So I take the freeway in search of Cinco de Mayo festivities. I find them downtown. It's Sunday, Uno de Mayo. And there are 500,000 people in the streets. Cause for celebration right there. Downtown L.A. on a Sunday is usually more of a city post-radioactive cloud. People free. Today, there are bodies jammed shoulder to shoulder over a 36-block area of food tents, sales booths, 4 concert stages. I'm a gringo in a sea of Latinos.
Do you have any English?
No.
I don't read Spanish.
You can live your whole life in Spanish in L.A. Latinos are the biggest ethnic group in the city. Whites, African-Americans, Asians, we're all minorities here. I don't speak Spanish, and I think I'm having a pseudo-immigrant experience on this sidewalk. This must be what it felt like to be the first Mexican in Vermont. Then I find 17-year-old Martha, the daughter of Guatemalan parents. She's here to meet other Latinos.
Oh, they're from Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, Colombia. There's different cultures. Even though we have different cultures, we're still the same, you know. We're all Hispanic, so that's why it draws all these people right here.
It draws so many people. Cinco de Mayo is now celebrated by more people in the U.S. than in Mexico, and it's a Mexican holiday. Honestly, I think this Whoop It Up stopped being about a Mexican army victory a long time ago. To test this theory, I asked Martha what the day celebrates.
It's Cinco de Mayo. It's a Mexican tradition. The independence, they gain independence in Mexico.
Actually, Mexican Independence Day is in September. If Latinos are getting this wrong, Cinco de Mayo, in L.A. at least, has passed the first test of all big American holidays. It's an effect that's lost its cause, like chocolate bunnies and Easter. And it's gaining ground on the second test, how crassly commercial we can make it. The alcohol industry got that started with Drinko for Cinco campaigns that turned the day into a beer fest at colleges across the country. The kickoff fiesta swirling around me is sponsored by a hamburger chain, golden arches everywhere. People are lined up at booths for free salad, aspirin, t-shirts, cell phone plans. A family passes me with plastic giveaway bags in every hand, and a case of lime Coca-Cola sharing stroller space with the baby.
They just come over here for the freebies.
Francisco is a Mexican-American. He plans to mark Cinco de Mayo with a family barbecue. He thinks this mega block party is about something else.
It brings like Latin people together. Come over here, look at the all the celebrities, singers, and all that.
The bands on stage are from all over Latin America, and so, originally, is a lot of the crowd. This fiesta tries to distill a citywide mix of different Hispanic cultures into a common essence: language, food, love of music, and family. Cinco de Mayo in L.A. has morphed into a kind of Happy Latino Day. Standing with the crowd in front of a concert stage, I feel too pale, too tall, too bony, and too mute to blend in. But I'm tolerated in a friendly enough way. Cinco de Mayo in L.A. may be a big commercial holiday in danger of losing its soul, but Latinos still eat, drink, and dance the night away. And I hope they'll go easy on the not-so-festive bullets.
On Point contributor Jennifer Westaway at the Cinco de Mayo kickoff fiesta in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.